are in La Jolla at the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, just down the street from the Salk Institute, where the sixth, well, we'll talk about that in a minute, the sixth stem cell meeting on
the Mesa. Or maybe the seventh, we're not really sure.
Is being held. We were with Larry Goldstein, Lawrence Goldstein, who's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator and distinguished professor, Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine, Department of Neurosciences, and director of the UC San Diego Stem Cell Program, and a longtime advocate of the intersection between science and public policy, particularly around the issue of stem cells. And we go back to the first meeting of the first public meeting of the Science Network,
yeah,
1 month before Proposition 71. Yeah.
A great event.
I always had the sense was kind of like the progenitor of the stem cell meeting on the Mesa.
Well, it was the first. It literally was the first stem cell meeting on the Mesa, as far as I know. It was certainly the first one that included the public, law, philosophy, ethics, science. I mean, it really started a grand tradition of interdisciplinary meetings, where interdisciplinary didn't just include scientists and engineers. Mm. And I think it was really a great first start, and it's continuing in that tradition now.
And this morning we were at the opening of the Sanford Consortium, Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which is another major milestone, yep, in the development. You're moving your lab, in fact, from UCSD, yep, over into the, yep, into the, yep, Sanford Consortium.
School of Medicine, that's right.
Your thoughts at this point, this transition point?
It's tremendously exciting and always a little scary. So, labs in some ways are like your home. I mean, you know, you've got your house, you've got your neighbors, you've got your school districts, you've got all the ways you know of how to do things. And your lab is similar. I have my neighbors over there. I have places nearby I go to eat and talk and collaborate and use equipment and everything else, as do the people in my lab. And we're just going to uproot a month from now and move into a totally new place, a brand new building, a brand new location where there are no other UCSD science buildings within a stone's throw. And it's a brand new experiment with a multidisciplinary, multi-institutional, shared space that we're hoping will break the mold for how we do science. So it's tremendously exciting, but it's also unknown. So, you know, there are simple things like, where are we going to get coffee anyway? And is that centrifuge going to work? And can, yeah, we still do those experiments over there? And how are we going to live? So, yeah, it's also, like any great adventure, a little anxious as well, but it's a wonderful thing to do.
At the ceremony this morning, the opening ceremony, the ribbon cutting and so on, several people used the phrase that because there were several institutions involved in a collaborative adventure, they actually called it a collaboratory.
Yeah.
I actually remember Jonas Salk using
that
phrase a long time ago.
Well, I mean, I know that it got...
Which would be nice.
I actually know of another place that's been used, so I think it's not unique to this,
right,
venture. But it's an interesting description. Obviously, it's a set of laboratories, and the emphasis really is on collaboration. You know, I think at the end of the day, if you think about it, problems in human medicine and disease are tough. And scientists working together under the right circumstances can solve problems in groups that they can't solve as individuals sometimes. And that's what we're going to try to do.
Yeah, Dick Atkinson, former Chancellor of UCSD, former president of the University of California, former director of the National Science Foundation.
Smart guy.
Said that he really thought it was his opinion, but he really did think that this town was probably the only place that this could have happened, the Mesa area.
I think that's probably right. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways it's in the water here.
Yeah.
It's in the environment. It's in the culture. Yeah. And, you know, you may or may not remember, Roger, I moved here from Harvard in 1993, in part because this place seemed exciting. It seemed new. It seemed like a place where interdisciplinary science was alive and well and possible. And boy, it's absolutely true. You know, over the years, I've had lots of offers to move other places, take other jobs, be head of this or that. Nothing holds a candle to this place at the end of the day, in my opinion. It's just so interesting to work here. And it means you can do stuff that's just off the radar. And has a chance of having high impact because it's unusual.
Yeah. One of the little presentations this morning was by Lorraine Steele, who's a patient advocate. And What she said, I noted this down. She said, what this place represents to us patient advocates who've been here pushing from Prop 71, which you were so involved with Bob Klein and so on. She said, this is 150,000 square feet, not of laboratories, 150,000 square feet of hope, of empowerment. So there's an awful lot of stock being set in where this stem cell field can go. So I want to try and get a bit of a grip from your perspective of realistically where we are at this point. And I'm thinking about a couple of pieces that I mentioned to you, a couple of commentaries. There were three pieces in Nature in March of this year, and a commentary by Martin Perro, who probably didn't write the headline, but it nevertheless says the dark side of induced pluripotency.
Hey, you got to sell journals.
They have great potential, great therapeutic potential. You know, epigenomic analyses of these cells generated using current technology reveal abnormalities that may affect their use. There were three papers in there following this. One on copy number variation selection during reprogramming. There was another one on hotspots with Ron Evans and Joe Ecker, also from Salk, signing on it, and Bing Ran, Jamie Thompson. Hotspots of aberrant epigenomic reprogramming in human-induced pluripotent stem cells. And then your paper with a bunch of colleagues on somatic coding mutations in human-induced pluripotent stem cells. We'll come back to that paper in a minute because it has some interesting aspects. But I'd like to get a sense from you, and also from, you know, Perra's most recent piece in October Nature Methods, Proteomes of Native-Induced Pluripotent Stem Cells. Again, a story here about differences in ability to differentiate into specific lineages. You've written a book called Stem Cells for Dummies in that series. How do we dummies make sense of this kind of really complicated stuff and know where the field is and whether it's dangerous or...
Okay, great question. So let me take it from the top. So first of all, dummies is a terrible term. It's just that, you know, it has to get used because that's the name of the series, right? I've always preferred, you know, stem cells for smart people who don't know about them yet, right? Okay. You know, I mean, a lot of what science is about jargon. It's just stuff you don't know. So getting past that, you know, I think the thing to remember ultimately is there are two issues about developing new medical therapies, whether they use stem cells or drugs or recombinant proteins or any of the advances we've seen over the decades and we'll see in the coming years. And the two issues are, one, any medical therapy, even a proven one, has risks when you treat people. And we could say a therapy is approved, it can be marketed, when we know that the risks are outweighed by the benefits or the potential benefits. Mm-hmm. So that's point one. So there's always risk. The second is when you're developing a new therapy, every step of the way, you're going to discover new risks, new potential benefits. It's just part of the nature of discovery and development that's part of what it takes to develop a new medical therapy. And so when you discover a new problem, I look at it as an opportunity. If you discover it early enough, you discover it before you've got it in human patients where it could potentially do something bad. That's a good thing, actually. And you have to expect that as you're going from understanding a little bit to understanding enough to really treat a person, if you're lucky, you're going to discover the things that are potentially risky so that you can deal with them and figure out how to drop that risk and raise the potential benefits. That's just the nature of the beast in developing new therapies. Now, if you ask the question, where are we now? You know, what are the prospects look like now versus what they looked like, say, 6 or 7 years ago, which is maybe an interesting question to think about. Mm-hmm. I think it's mixed, as is always the case. On the one hand, to a guy like me, who's really in the trenches, trying to figure out how to take these really wonderful ideas and wonderful technologies and get them into human patients as fast as possible. On the one hand, the upside now looks much bigger than it ever looked. I mean, in terms of looking at this set of technologies and imagining and thinking about What are the prospects for developing them in productive ways? What are the kinds of interventions you might make? All the sorts of good things that might come out of it. That list is longer than it ever was. I mean, really good ideas coming out of the field for how you might use these technologies. Mm-hmm. The leavening, if you will, the thing that, you know, you say, well, okay, but what are the risks? And yeah, so we've learned more about just how hard it's going to be. And that also is what happens in a new area of science with lots of different opportunities. What you find is that some of them go faster than you expected, and some of them go more slowly. Mm-hmm. And we get both, and we've been getting both in this area. So what's going more slowly is, yeah, it's a little harder to get these cells to behave themselves for possible cell transplant therapies, for diabetes or Lou Gehrig's disease or things like that. Although, to be honest, things are moving along pretty swimmingly. The problems are getting worked out. On the other hand, there have been a couple of early hits in ways that we didn't expect. So Kat Jameson's work on finding drugs for myeloproliferative disorders, diseases where you make too many blood cells. The technologies of stem cell biology, not embryonic stem cells yet, but some of the technologies with adult stem cells, led directly to discoveries that popped a drug into clinical trials in record time. And it's a drug that's making a real difference for those patients. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you get a few wins, you get a few losses. At the end of the day, you have enough parallel investigations. Some go well and some hit bumps.
So what are you working on yourself at this point? Let's actually go to this paper, because it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah, we've got a bunch of things cooking at the moment, not surprisingly.
But what was going on in here, again, for a general audience, who wouldn't necessarily
know the difference
between embryonic stem cells, except that they're supposed to be not a good thing in this country, but less...
Actually,
less...
they're a great thing in this country.
There
have been a lot of arguments in this country, and there are still pockets in this country that don't like them. And of course, in California, people are fine with it. Actually, most polls suggest that most Americans are fine with it, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Is there a comparison to be made between embryonic stem cells and induced pluripotent stem cells?
So let's take a step back.
Yeah.
So stem cells, right? You know, these are just cells that when they divide, they both replenish themselves. And they can become some of the specialized cell types in an adult: skin, hair, heart, lung, kidney, whatever. So it's like, you go back to the Dustin Hoffman movie, The Graduate. The advice he got was plastics. And so if you think about, he got a lot of other advice too, but this is the advice we'll talk about. But in this case, what you've got are biological plastics that can self-replenish. They make more of themselves. I mean, this is terrific. This is what the century of biology in biomedicine is going to be here in the next, 90 years. It's going to be learning to use biological plastic to do great stuff, making organs, treating disease, what have you. Okay, we're at the beginning of that. So we've got biological plastics, and there's lots of different kinds. There are so-called adult stem cells from adults such as yourself. All your different organs and tissues have stem cells, and they're all different from each other. Fat, heart, muscle, lung, kidney, blah, 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 blah. They all, or many of them, seem to have, quote, adult stem cells, and they have different properties. You have embryonic stem cells, which come from the frozen embryos left over after in vitro fertilization treatments that are going to be discarded no matter what. Those can grow, and they can make every adult cell type, and they behave pretty well in the lab, whereas most of the cell types from an adult don't behave so well in the lab, it turns out. For obvious reasons, they don't grow well. That's their job, not to grow very well in their normal environment. Mm-hmm. And in their normal environment, if, for example, they're, blood-forming stem cells in the bone marrow, they just make blood.
Yeah, they're
brain stem cells make brain. You know, that's their job. They shouldn't do anything different.
Committed careers.
That's right. They're committed. Then they can't change careers in general without some really heavy genetic trickery.
Right.
And then there are the so-called reprogrammed stem cells, which because of Shinya Yamanaka's discoveries about reprogramming factors, these cells, you can start with skin or hair or a variety of adult cell types. When you treat them with the right genetic factors, you can induce them to acquire the properties of embryonic stem cells, or most of the properties, but not all. so that they'll grow for long periods in the lab, they're pretty easy to handle, and they'll make any adult cell type. But they're not identical to embryonic stem cells. And in fact, no two types of stem cells are identical to the others. They're all different. They all have pluses and minuses. They have different handling behavior. You know, if you go to your garage, well, maybe you don't have a toolbox, Roger, I don't know. But if you go to most people's garage, there's a toolbox, and if it's mine, it's got dozens of different kinds of tools. And every tool has a different role. It has different pluses and minuses. Yes, it is true. You can hammer in a nail with a wrench, but I wouldn't recommend it. And you can take out a screw with pliers, but I wouldn't recommend that. So you got to use the right tool for the right job, and medicine is the same way, right?
All right. So thank you for that little primer, or primer, as they say sometimes in this country, on Stem Cells 101, which is extremely helpful. This paper, then, let's unpack this paper in terms of what you've just said there. Somatic coding mutations in human-induced pluripotent stem cells. And also,
one of those jargon titles in a foreign language.
And also speak
to... the idea is really simple.
Speak to the fact that that there appear to be CV fibroblasts in here. There's a little hidden story.
There's a hidden story, okay.
Which is very appropriate for anything to do with the genome.
That's exactly right. So the backstory is that... J. Craig Venter, who now spends part of his time in San Diego, he has a house here, has a company here, and his institute is moving on to the UCSD campus, and with whom we collaborate quite a bit. Craig also is a UCSD alumnus, as am I. Mm-hmm. I've known Craig for a long time and interacted with him scientifically for many, many years. Craig's complete genome was sequenced by his institute a couple of years ago. And Craig and I got to talking. And the thing that's really interesting is that using these reprogramming technologies, you can actually make a stem cell line, starting with Craig's skin cells, that has Craig's completely sequenced genome in them. So you know right off the bat, all of the genetic variants that Craig has that predispose him to all sorts of different diseases that we know about. So, you know, let's unpack that, to use your term. What do I mean by that? When you go to a doctor to get your physical, or maybe you think you're sick, whatever, first thing they do is they ask you about your family history, right? Mm-hmm. Did you have a parent with heart disease, Alzheimer's disease, what have you? And why do they do that? It's effectively a genetic history. Mm-hmm. It's because a lot of human diseases have significant contributions from genetics. They're not purely genetic, mm-hmm. but because each of us has different variations in our genomes, our cells and organs are affected in different ways by environment and have different ways that they're predisposed to different types of failures. But it turns out that I'm interested in Alzheimer's disease, and Craig has a bunch of variants that predispose people to Alzheimer's disease. And that got me very interested in this. So Craig and I don't remember exactly how this started up, but you know, we sat down, we agreed we were going to take a biopsy of Craig, we were going to grow out his skin cells, and we were going to reprogram them to make these reprogrammed stem cell lines. And so we went off and we did that. And so we had these stem cell lines from Craig. And the first question that came up was, okay, we made these. Can we think of anything interesting to do with them right away? And one of the students in my lab said, gee, we ought to see if the sequence of the reprogrammed stem cells is the same as Craig's real baseline, what we sometimes call the germline sequence. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we teamed up with Kun Zhang, a young bioengineer who works on genomics and bioinformatics at UCSD, a wonderful young scientist, mm-hmm. and his student Athervagor and some other folks in his lab. Mm-hmm. And we sequenced what's called the exome of Craig's stem cells, which is just the parts of the genome that code for proteins. And what we discovered is that there were a lot more genetic changes in those protein coding regions than we thought there should be. Because we have rough estimates of every time a cell divides, you have a low probability that you'll make a mistake in the DNA. And so we have an idea of what the rate should be, and it was about 10 times as high as it should have been.
Meaning?
There was 10 times as much genetic damage as we thought there should have been. And the type of damage was not completely random either. The type of damage that was there when Atherva looked carefully was similar to the type of damage you see in cancer cells. And on reflection, none of this is surprising, we think. So you know, we track down the origin of these changes to the best of our ability with methods that are still far too crude for what we're trying to do. And we looked at lots of different stem cell lines from multiple labs around the country, reprogrammed using lots and lots of different methods, including so-called safe methods, where there's no apparent, you think that it's not, you're not disrupting the genome in any way because you're using factors that are thought not to disrupt the genome. And they all have about the same rate of genetic damage. And using a variety of sophisticated measurement techniques, we were able to figure out that probably about a third to a half of the genetic damage that we were seeing was pre-existing in the skin cells, in the donors before skin samples were taken. So throughout life and throughout development, a certain amount of damage accumulates. So that's the source of some of it. And then the other source we think is in fact happening during the reprogramming process itself when, what's the right way to think about this? You know, it's like you've all of a sudden taken a box full of carefully packed books and turned the box upside down. All the books are scattered on the floor and now you're gonna repack them but in a different order. And so it's gone through a big transformation to go from a very orderly arrangement to a completely disorderly arrangement and then back to an orderly arrangement. And we had wondered, in fact, whether that would induce genetic damage during the process. There's some theoretical reasons for thinking that might happen. And in fact, that looks to be about the source of half the damage as well, is there. But then the kicker is that when you grow the cells up in culture after this initial reprogramming, because you start with one cell that's been reprogrammed and then it divides to make two and then you grow millions of them so you can work with them, there's selection for those rare variations that improve growth, we think, in a dish. And so that we think is the story of what's happening here, which we wouldn't have discovered without having Craig and his already sequenced genome to fool around with.
I should stress, by the way, that obviously, as we've discussed, I mean, he's quite open about
yes,
this.
Yes, absolutely. So he published.
But he does that.
He publishes. In some ways, he thinks of himself as patient zero, I think. You know, it's sort of the archetype of the human condition. Yeah. I mean, he's really wonderful in that way. So, yeah, so he had published his sequence in a scientific journal when they first determined it with all of its interrelationships and all the variants, and he published what his predispositions to disease were. And then we, of course, when we took a sample, we had full IRB approval of working with an identified donor. He signed an informed consent that was unique to him as a non-anonymous donor. So this is all, we're very cautious about this sort of thing.
So, but I mean, looking forward to the future where you've got lots of people whose genomes are sequenced and so on.
Yeah, boy.
Then is this a sort of a stereotypical test case for what you could do in terms of diseases in dish that you could...
This is just the beginning.
Prototypical.
Yeah, so now it gets cool. So this was just, this is the tip of the iceberg now, right? So let me give you an example of one thing we're trying to do, okay? So we can take Craig's stem cells.
Right.
And using standard methodology that my lab and other labs use, we can make them into human brain cells. So now we've got Craig's brain cells in a dish, which is sort of an interesting concept in and of itself. And then we can ask, do the variants that he has, which are known to be correlated with increased risk to disease, do his brain cells have any of the biochemical behaviors that we expect based on the nature of those variants? To just begin to ask the question, are those variants affecting the behavior of the cells based on what we expect from genetic studies? And then we have ways of directly manipulating those genetic elements in his brain cells and asking if we change from what you might think of as the risk type that promotes risk to disease and convert it in some way to what we think of as the protective type Does that change the behavior of the cells in the way that's predicted? And every one of those is ultimately an avenue to developing a therapy, if our ideas about what they do are correct. So it gives us a way to dissect how each individual's unique genetic architecture predisposes them to disease at that level with these kinds of measurements. It's not the whole story because of environment, but it's the beginning of a very cool story.
There's a piece in the November Nature Methods, Neurons from Reprogrammed Cells, piece by Monia Baker, in which she talks about the potential being vast of diseases in a dish, so is the uncertainty. So, you know, early days, but, the potential.
Well, guys like
fruits,
me, at the end of the day, if you're going to be a scientist, you have to work off potential. Because the nature of research is you think that you're going to go to the lab every day and solve a problem that you couldn't solve yesterday or discover something new that isn't yet known. So you have to have the view that you're going to explore and find something. That's the nature of the beast. And really, the trick in dealing with the public is, you know, if you will, to communicate that excitement, to explain why you think you can discover something, and to be realistic about how hard it is to actually do the discoveries. It's tremendously hard. Of course it is. Otherwise, it'd all be done. But the nature of the beast is you can actually make progress.
How did you, I mean, you actually did, you were actually here at UCSD originally before going to the University of Washington, Seattle for your PhD and so on. Is there, as you look back, and I'm not saying just before you went to university, is there some point at which you knew that science or medicine or something was going to be, and what was the stimulus for that? Was there, it was a book?
Ancient history. No, it was a faculty member. I mean, when you look at most scientists, you'll find a faculty member usually in their career somewhere who made all the difference. And for me, it was a faculty member here at UCSD who let me work in his lab. And it enabled me to, for the first time.
You got hooked on it.
Oh man, did I get hooked. There's nothing like experimental science if you've got the right temperament for it. Yeah. It's great. So I had thought I wanted to go to medical school, as every biology major at every major university thinks they do when they first start. And being able, getting a chance to try out research in this guy's lab made all the difference. So, you know, stop the plans for medical school, off you go to graduate school. And it changed everything.
So at this point, now there's a nice little book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. I mean, what do you tell your flock at this point? I mean, what advice do you give to young scientists?
Do what you're excited about. Do what you're passionate about, and you'll do well at it, and everything else takes care of itself. Terrible advice. but it is true. It's the way to be happy and productive, and what else could you do in life?
Yeah. So, in terms of the where you see, I mean, in the Alzheimer's work, I mean, that's your primary focus, we'd say?
It's the major one, yeah.
The CIRM's person this morning was talking about moving diseases from incurable category to the category of curable.
I would think about treatable, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any, somewhere in the back of your mind, any kind of timeline on that kind of stuff?
I mean, well, nobody can ever know the answer to that question. It's ultimately unanswerable. I get asked, you know, and of course, it is the right question to ask if you're not the scientist trying to solve the problem. I mean, you want to know, right? You know, you got a parent, you got a wife, you got a kid with a disease. The last thing you want to hear is, I don't know. What a terrible answer. But that's the honest answer. But maybe another way to think about it is, if you don't do research, you will not find a better therapy. And that's, I think you need to turn it around. If you don't try to make a difference, if you don't try to solve the problem and find a new therapy, the answer is you'll never find a therapy for that disease. It's the research process which makes it possible to find something. And whether it's going to be 6 months, unlikely, although you never know, or 10 years or 15 years, by starting the work and getting going and trying to figure out exactly what's going on in the diseased and damaged cells, you get that much closer to finding a therapy. And the thing that's exciting about the stem cell revolution, if you will, that makes so many of us think that it's going to make a big difference sooner, is the ability to work on human tissues in ways we never could before. I mean, I know I've used this example on you before, but if I want to work on human brain cells of any sort, I can't just drill a hole in your head and take out a sample any more than I could drill a hole in Craig's head and take out a sample. But by having his stem cells now and being able to work with them in the lab, we can learn things about his susceptibility to disease we couldn't otherwise learn. If we have cells from Alzheimer's patients that have genetic changes that absolutely 100% of the time would give them Alzheimer's disease, we can study human brain cells, which are really different from mouse brain cells and fruit fly brain cells and all other kinds of brain cells, in the details of their biochemistry, and ask what's going wrong. And so on the one hand, you know, we sometimes talk about model organisms. We love model organisms because we can do experiments and discover biology that you would never discover working on an intact human. You know, telomeres, small RNAs, inhibitory RNAs, protein synthesis, all these things got worked out in model organisms. But model organisms are not identical to humans at the end of the day. Their cells are different, so the general principles are the same. Mm-hmm. But if you need to actually discover and test a drug or a therapy, at some point you got to work on humans. And the sooner you get to that step, the better off you are.
Yeah.
The analogy I like to use is you think of model organisms as motorcycles and Volkswagens and humans as Cadillacs. So the engines still have the same principles, but the parts aren't interchangeable, right? Mm-hmm.
So in terms of some of the technical issues,
yeah,
in getting back to what I would loosely call a blank slate state, yeah, for a stem cell, so that it can become something else, there's lots of articles talking about epigenetic issues, lineage issues, and so, yeah, on and so forth. These are probably just technical things, you think? I mean, do you see any fundamental reason why they can't be solved? Presumably not, otherwise we wouldn't be doing it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, guys like me at the end of the day do vote with our feet, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to commit my life to something. I got to make decisions about what I'm going to do. I think these are problems that are solvable. But, you know, solvable is not the same thing as solved. So we're working on solving them. I don't see anything that theoretically, you know, scares me so much that I think it's not something that's going to provide, that there's not a path forward for most of these technologies.
Mm.
And... you know, the good thing about what's happening in California is that it's bringing lots of scientists who hadn't previously been stem cell scientists into the field, bringing their unique expertise to the field, which is terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think, you know, with a lot of smart people, not just one, with lots of smart people working in a field on a set of problems in parallel, that's how you make an impact as a society.
Talk about the culture of science, though. You talked about the collaboratory, you talk about the people working together, and people have this sort of notion that that's what science does. It's this wonderful enterprise of people all coming together. We also know that there are some strong personalities, and there are people who...
Yeah, myself among them, that's right.
If you haven't published the paper with your name on it, then you're not going to get the next step in advancement and so on.
Yeah.
Is this field, though, different? Is it?
No. All fields of scientists, of science, and all fields of scientists are more or less the same. I mean, there are cultural differences between physicists and biologists. But by and large, people are people.
Yeah.
I mean, whether they're business people or scientists or physicians or whatever, people are people. And, I mean, on the one hand, the culture of science is, you know, historically the idea of the lone scientist in the dark laboratory at night doing things all on their own. And the more modern way, of course, is really teams of scientists working together. And if you're going to collaborate and work together, you got to submerge your ego a little bit. And you have to ultimately recognize that submerging your ego a little bit pays off in terms of getting more interesting things done and being able to accomplish more. None of us is saints or, you know, we're altruists. We work because we're interested in solving problems, because we feel rewarded when we solve problems. Some of those rewards are monetary for some people. Some of them are recognition. You know, to expect scientists to not be humans would be a mistake. And so we find ways of managing that within our institutions so that people work together productively.
Mm. Did you ever consider doing anything else? I mean, are you a frustrated opera singer or something?
No, I obviously I thought about being a physician at one point.
Yeah.
I've toyed with the idea over the years of, gee, you know, should I go be a CEO or run this major organization or do this or that? But at the end of the day, I'm really happy with the kind of lifestyle and intellectual lifestyle I have, being what I call a bench scientist, having my own laboratory where I collaborate with other scientists, where I train students and postdocs and have people in my lab that work with me on problems. And I like the San Diego way of doing science. I mean, I like the interdisciplinary culture. I like the fact that I have colleagues at lots of institutions that I'm happy working with. And so, you know, I've toyed with the idea of doing other things, but rarely for more than 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah. Speak about the relationship between science and society, between politics and where you see that at this point.
Well, you know, I think if there's one area that might make me sad, it's that as a scientific community, we still do a fairly poor job talking to our neighbors, talking to people in the community about what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, guys like you are part of the solution to that. The media as a group ultimately is the way that scientists such as myself can communicate with large numbers of people about what we do and why it has value. But the problem we face in American society, which is, you know, I'm not going to worry about the rest of the world at the moment, but in American society, is that we're wildly underinvested in science in general relative to the problems we want it to solve. Mm-hmm. So you take just Alzheimer's disease as one small example. A problem where the cost to society and Medicare and government and all of us runs into the trillions over the coming years, where the emotional cost to families is enormous. And, you know, the public invests, you know, somewhere between $1 and $2 billion a year in trying to solve it. So $1 trillion problems, $1 billion tools, 1,000 to 1 odds. I mean, so we're really outnumbered. So why is that? I mean, there are a lot of reasons. People have their daily pressures. They have their own, you know, social, you know, their own families to worry about. There's mistrust of government to misuse funds. Government doesn't always allocate sensibly. And science is this mysterious thing where people think it's somehow easy, or the guy who goes down on the corner and says, I've solved it, you don't need to pay all these scientists, right? You know, none of that's true. And it's because I think that at the end of the day, there isn't a lot of understanding by non-scientists of what scientists do, what it costs, why it's valuable, and what are reasonable time frames to think about changing. And you know, that's sad both from the standpoint of combating disease, which I'd argue is, you know, the number one national security issue is, you know, taking care of your health, defending the health of your family. Is talk about a national security issue or a defense issue. My goodness, right? So that, you know, there's that issue. And then, of course, there's the economic health issue. So if you think about our country, if you want to have a healthy economy, you have to make stuff that people want to pay money for. And better therapies for disease, actually, that's a pretty good business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look at it and I think, okay, in the next 10 or 20 years, would I rather be living in a country where we're discovering and then marketing the drugs for Alzheimer's disease? Or do I want to be paying the residents of another country who've invested and invented those drugs, and I'm going to pay them for those drugs for Alzheimer's disease? And, you know, at the end of the day, I come down squarely on the side of, I want to do it here, but we have to be willing to make the social investment.
So when he came into office, President Obama said this administration should restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
What's the rightful place of science?
Oh, boy, that's a deep question. You know, truly, I think it should really be as part of everybody's life. And I mean that in probably two different ways. I mean, what Obama was saying about restoring science to its rightful place, I think is using data that have been acquired in rigorous, careful ways and that are trustworthy to make decisions, and to make those decisions in a way that is free of politics and based solely on that information. Mm-hmm. And to provide that information to the government that then makes whatever decisions it's going to make. But that the information at least is untainted by politics. I mean, I think that's what Obama meant. But I think more broadly, what I would love to see someday, I don't think I'll live to see this really, is for people to learn how to use the scientific method, if you will, in their own lives to make decisions about the world. Not emotional decisions, but, you know, is it more dangerous to take an airplane or to drive to a distant destination? actually the plane is usually safer. You know, so to actually use the scientific method of evaluating information to make decisions. Because there's lots of economic data, there's lots of data on medicine, lots of things that people often make decisions based on anecdote rather than real information. You hear people say, I smoked for 75 years and I never got lung cancer. Cigarettes must not cause cancer then, right? Well, now wait a second. We're talking about risk. So if you've got an 80% chance of developing lung cancer after you smoke for 75 years with cigarettes, you'd say, well, that's a pretty good cause and effect relationship. But yes, 20% of the people won't develop cancer. We don't know why. We'd love to know why. But that's going to happen. So using information in that way is, to me, what science is about in a social setting. You know, plus discovering things about the world and understanding the information. So, you know, when people advertise, quote, therapies for diseases where, you know, one person is found who got better, that doesn't mean we've proven it. You have to do lots of people and the statistics and everything else. So that's what I'd like to see happen.
Yeah, that's good. If I gave you a time travel token and allowed you to bring to your dinner table anybody from any discipline, from any period of history whatsoever, that you could sit down and grill
question
and ask questions of them.
I've never thought about that.
Who would you love to have at your table?
Boy, you know, a bunch of names come to mind. You know, Darwin's probably on top of the list. I mean, that's a guy who really figured out a broad, important concept. And he did it with pretty crude tools, just by thinking about it and coming up with logic and everything else. He's a good one. Thomas Hunt Morgan, who, you know, stimulated the use of the fruit fly in genetics and started a school of scientists second to none for figuring out the basics of heredity and how it worked. I knew Barbara McClintock peripherally. I'd met her a couple of times over the years. As a student, we hosted her for a seminar in the program I was at. She was quite a person. Sturtevant is someone else, you know, would be really interesting. He's the one who invented genetic mapping when he was an undergraduate student in Morgan's group. Smart, smart guy. Yeah, those are the ones that come to mind.
Yeah. The next steps in your when you get established in the new facility?
I mean, I got a long list of things I want to do. We hopefully will start testing drugs for Alzheimer's disease using Alzheimer's cells in a dish. We will hopefully work on developing some diagnostics that'll predict more accurately who might develop disease based on testing their skin cells made into stem cells, made into brain cells to see if they have aberrant behavior. I'd love to use these cells to really figure out what's going wrong in brain cells when they develop Alzheimer-like behavior. I think all of these things are things we can do that I'm really excited about. And in my spare time, we're working on developing a cell-based therapy for Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
on Fridays. So when you do these talks, I mean, because you must have given a lot of public talks with the stem cells for smart people who don't speak the language of stem cells yet. And you say things like, okay, you know, we're taking a skin cell, we're turning that into a neuron, into a brain cell. Yeah. They must either say, oh, isn't that wonderful, or you people are kind of creepy.
Mostly I get wonderful.
You do?
I think it's biased in the following way. I think I only get invited to audiences that are going to find it to be interesting, to be honest. I think the audiences that would find it creepy don't invite me to begin with.
It is remarkable stuff, though, isn't it?
It's very cool. It's so cool. I love it.
I was just talking to Ian Wilmot earlier and thinking that Dolly's birthday was 1996.
It's not that long ago.
That's just 15 years ago.
It's not that long ago.
So,
you know, I was in graduate school in the late 70s. So, you know, 30 years ago. It's a long time in one sense. It's a short time in another. We do things in my lab on a daily basis that had you told me about them when I was a graduate student, science fiction.
Yeah.
Look at your phone, for crying out loud.
All right.
The world has changed.
What are you optimistic about? Last question.
I'm optimistic that we'll solve problems in disease. I mean, I really do think that this is how you go about doing it, and that we will find therapies for Alzheimer's disease and Lou Gehrig's disease, and I hope we'll do it in my lifetime. That's my goal. Mm-hmm. You know, how society chooses to use them, who knows? But we'll get them.
All right. Great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Roger.
And good luck when you move into your new facility.
It'll be a hoot.